Welcome to the iByIMD podcast, where IMD faculty meets global experts to bring you the latest on the evolving world of management and business. And here's your host of today's episode, Affiliate Professor of Leadership, Communications, and Organizational Change at IMD, Susan Goldsworthy. Enjoy.
I am delighted to welcome Anne Perrins, Chief Human Resource Officer at Atlassian Williams Formula One Team, to this iByIMD podcast. Anne has extensive experience in leading business transformation projects. Following early career experience in banking and management consulting, Anne spent the next 20 years in global engineering, technology, and operations environments, including 17 years with BP and several years with GKN Automotive. She joined the F1 team in June 2023 with a focus on building a thriving, positive culture to attract and retain the talent that's necessary to win multiple world championships. She's known as an advocate for early career talent, apprenticeships, and STEM pathways. In 2025, Williams joined forces with Atlassian, a leading provider of team collaboration and productivity software, and the company is now branded Atlassian Williams. Anne, very, very welcome.
Thank you so much, Susan. Great to be here.
May I ask, were you a fan of Formula One before joining the team? What has been your previous experience of Formula One?
I guess I should be diplomatic. So I should say I'm a super fan now, but did I grow up being a Formula One fan? I didn't, and I wish I'd found it earlier. I wish I'd known what an amazing and exciting sport it is and how much there is for everybody to enjoy.
Well, the good news about that is you didn't have to change teams then.
That's it. It's very easy to be blue and Williams all the way through.
Oh, I like that. Blue and Williams all the way through.
I didn't say that deliberately, but yeah.
That's great. Good branding. What initially attracted you to a role sitting at the intersection of elite sport, technology, and people leadership?
Yeah, that's a great question, Susan. I think, you know, when I interviewed for this job and met several members of the board and also James Vowles, who was just starting as team principal here, the thing that really drew me in and made me think this is actually the right thing for me to do as well is they had a really unshakable and clear belief in the power and actually the criticality of the people and culture agenda, that they recognise that this team can't return to winning unless we get that right. So for me, having always, or for many years, worked in technology and operations environment, to have the opportunity to do that and to bring transformation that I love, but into an elite sport, was just a unique opportunity.
It sounds phenomenal. I mean, you mentioned James as the team principal and that you're undergoing a significant rebuilding phase after years of struggle as a team. How critical is talent recruitment and retention to your team's transition strategy? And how does this differ from maybe other industries that you've worked in?
Building talent has been seen as absolutely critical. So right from the very first conversation with James, that was quite a big part of our conversation, actually, was about recruitment. And I led a big global recruitment team in my career history. So that was one thing that was clearly very important from the get-go. So this team, as you say, had this amazing legacy and heritage and had been really successful and had phenomenal people in the team already. So when I joined, we were about 750. And here we are just a little over 2 years later, and we now have 1,200 people in the team. So that probably tells you a lot of what you need to know in terms of how critical has it been to build the right talent and to recruit the right people. And, you know, here we are in the middle of the countryside in Oxfordshire and needing this very specific talent from lots of different backgrounds, technology, engineering, operations, business functions, and building the strength and the capacity and the capability to be able to recruit and retain talent is absolutely been a massive focus over the last 2 years.
I imagine that it might be a surprise to some of our listeners to hear that you have 1,200 employees when you, as a spectator of the sport, you maybe see 20 at the weekends or up front. How hierarchical is the structure?
I would say we're working hard for it not to be hierarchical. I think most modern organisations understand the benefit of not creating a lot of hierarchy and too much structure, just enough that you can be effective and people know what they need to do. So you're right, you know, from the outside, I think you see probably about, you know, if you're watching TV, maybe a maximum of about 20 people, but even trackside, there's in excess of 100 people at every race weekend from the team. So that just starts to give you a sense as you kind of unpack the layers. And then we have mission control back here, and there's another lots of people working back at the factory. And then beyond that, yeah, the hub of the business really is obviously not at the track, but 365 days a year, pretty much, there are people working at the factory and a very diverse workforce.
So that's interesting. What percentage of your employee population are actually, you know, very much working around the F1 calendar, and what percentage are day to day, you know, every day, 365 days a year?
Yeah, I guess, you know, like any organisation, there are sort of overlaps in what people do. So the people that go to the 24 races last season, many of them also work back at the factory. Some of them are not at all of the races. Some of them are at all the races. So there's lots of intersection. And I think it's just another feature of a modern Formula One team that there are just multiple layers. Once you get in the door, it's much bigger and more complex than you realize from the outside. So, you know, we have to have capability that is as deep and specific in finance, in HR, in legal, etc., as we do in engineering and operations.
And you mentioned that people, obviously the people part, the belief in the value of the people and the way to winning is through people. And so you've recently had this collaboration with Atlassian, which is known for its software around collaboration and productivity. How do you marry the technology with the people?
Yes, that's right. So many of our sponsors, I mean, we're now in a stage, I guess, of our development where our sponsors really are deep partners with the organization. So I think what you see again, kind of on the outside as the sort of casual observer, is stickers on the car, which looks like sponsorship. But actually, you know, you step into it and you realize that we're in very deep partnerships. So currently we have more than 14 partners that we're working with in very different ways. And Atlassian, as you say, has brought tremendous value and partnership to our organization with the know-how and the tools and the software to help collaboration. And that has just allowed us to accelerate our journey in the way that the culture is working as we connect people across different functions and often working in different places at different times across different teams. And really, we're only just getting started with the potential of that partnership.
It's very exciting. And it does seem like patience is necessary in the transformation process that you're undertaking in order to see the results. Is that true?
I think, Susan, you've really hit on a key theme for me that I've reflected on over the holidays. We're obviously just stepping into the new year as you and I are having this conversation. And patience is a really important word. I think, you know, we all tend to be, I imagine as leaders, most of us are impatient by nature. And you sort of step into something like this and it's very easy to underestimate what it takes to take an organization through transformation. And for me personally, having come from very large multinational corporations that operate actually on a different time scale, it's easy, I think, coming into Formula One to think everything's very fast, which it is, and it's a smaller organization, which it is. But actually to make the change happen, because it has to be so deep, and this is a, you know, an organization ultimately that will win in milliseconds and on absolute precision, the transformation journey is long and deep and complex, and every element ultimately we're going to have to get those right.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating, isn't it? That combination of the immediate focus and the speed and the results today, balanced with that long-term strategic view of we want to win, you know, in the next 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever it is.
That's right. Yeah, Susan. So I think that's been the challenge of leadership here, I think, is you've got to keep operating week in, week out on the world stage. And we need to be able to show progress and learn through that progress and create that journey and story towards winning. And at the same time, the strategy is very much, and the investment is very much about creating long term. And so for us, the journey to return to winning after a very storied past is a long one. It takes multiple years, but how do you kind of build success as you go? And to your point, winning a world championship, we know that that won't come easily and it won't come this year or next year. But making sure that we really understand the steps on that journey and we work towards those, that's really the challenge of leadership, is balancing those elements. So our mantra at the moment and our mission to win multiple world championships, if we sort of bring it a bit more forward in time, we want to be winning races. Our aim is to be winning races by 2028. And you can see through our performance last year, we're starting to create that belief, but also that performance that we can get there with the progress that we've made. But the progress that we make every season or every race, we're really prioritizing the progress that will help us learn and develop over the long term, rather than, as you say, the expediency of making sure that we win on track that week.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And one of the things that you've been introducing is an ambitious early career and STEM pipeline. Can you give us an insight into that initiative and why you're focusing on that?
Williams has a long history, actually, of bringing graduate talent into the organisation. So a real recognition, as many organisations do, to build future talent, you have to focus right at the start and really nurture and develop talent all the way through. So we've really grown on that as an ambition and as a core part of our talent strategy. Again, it comes back to the fact that we're here to build really sustainable performance that outlives certainly me and my career and goes way beyond that. And so to do that, you really have to take that long-term view. So we're now at a point where our early careers, various people on, whether it's industrial placements, so a year out from university, or a full graduate program that leads to a more long-term career here, or apprenticeships, etc., they make up about 12% of our population. So for a relatively small organisation, it's a massive investment. And I think what I was really struck by when I joined, and having worked obviously in big corporates where we do have these kind of programmes, I think the thing that did stand out for me here was the early accountability and the real impact that every single one of those graduates has the opportunity to make. So the development programme has continued to grow and evolve, but what we've really worked hard to retain is that all of our early careers, they have the opportunity from day one. And this is really part of our employee value proposition more broadly, is we want every single person to join feeling that from day one, they have the opportunity to make real impact as well as learn. So those things we've really stayed true to. And I think that's what differentiates us from some other graduate programs. And as a result, it's really competitive. It's really popular. So we have upwards of about 20,000 applications for our graduate roles. So it's an amazing program to be part of and critical to our future.
Yeah, I can imagine you're flooded with inquiries and applications. Do you see that some of that talent might go to other teams, for example, after the programme?
We're doing our best for that not to happen, or for it to happen less than it did in the past. And I think that did happen more when I first joined. And so we are now obviously putting a lot of emphasis through the whole organisation actually on retaining talent. There is no good in any organisation having a bucket that's got lots of holes in it and you keep having to recruit from the market and people leave and you don't really understand why. So making sure that we offer culture and organisation, a career path that is really compelling no matter where you are in your career for the best talent is fundamental. So yeah, a couple of years ago, we were losing quite a bit of our graduate talent to the competition. And I think that has slowed significantly. And we are now seen as more of a destination for talent. So we are much stronger, not just from an early careers perspective, but more broadly in being able to attract talent from other teams. And that is definitely a big part of the competition.
That's wonderful. So you've moved from a training academy to actually, as you say, a destination blue through and through.
I think so. Never be complacent about these things, because people have ambitions and careers they want to and need to pursue. And so it's incumbent on us as leaders and for everybody in the organisation to create the environment and to deliver the performance, engage people in a way that makes them want to stay and create reasons why people really want to stay on this journey. And yeah, that is a really important part that all of us in the exec team are really tuned into.
And on the people side, Formula One is often perceived, either fairly or unfairly, as lacking diversity, particularly beyond the drivers. From your perspective, what's behind that perception? Do you see genuine progress? Do you see some systemic barriers that may exist? And what can Atlassian Williams do to actively reshape the employee profiles?
Yes, so I have spent most of my career in engineering and technology organisations. It's a global challenge that the best talent, wherever it is in the world, have access to these careers. And as you know, it starts with education. And that's been a huge investment that we've made here, growing that education programme. So we now have a really thriving, incredible on-site STEM programme. So last year was our sort of, you know, our big step up year really in embedding that STEM program. So this is for school children where we give the experience of a day where they come on site and see what some of those STEM careers look like for in real life, if you like, at Williams in this environment. And they have an amazing experience. And we delivered that at zero cost last year to more than 13,000 children who came on site. So we, just to give you a sense of how popular it is, we release our slots every quarter and they're gone within 10 minutes. So we work with many schools that come from near and far to join that programme. And that's really about creating that future talent pipeline of engineering, maths, technology, science, etc. And really just to instill that early enthusiasm and love of science and to understand where it can take you.
That's phenomenal, because it has a glamour to it as an industry, doesn't it? With all the locations around the world and the fast cars. And yet it is a lot of precision work, day-to-day detail approach. And so it's lovely that they get the opportunity to experience the almost family feel, I imagine. Is it a family feel, you would say, at Williams?
I think it is. We obviously have that heritage from Frank Williams, and that really lives on, and you see it everywhere and people talk about it and know about it even from the outside. And some of our big moments in the year, we work incredibly hard. There are very, very long hours in the factory for everybody. But then we have these big moments at the end of season where we all come together, or in the summer where we have our family festival and we're able to open the doors to our friends and family and just give them a flavour of that experience and what it feels like. So yeah, creating the kind of the relationship and the team feel and the connections between us as individuals and teams is fundamental, I believe, to our success. And everybody invests so much to be here. It's really demanding. So if you don't have those relationships and connections and support for each other, I think it very quickly becomes impossible.
So this creation of psychological safety and trust must be critical in getting people to work across these very different areas and fields towards one goal.
It's critical, and we've spent a lot of time thinking, talking, working on psychological safety as part of this culture and transformation. I think it's always a work in progress. It's a bit like saying, you know, do the best people want to join and stay? And making sure we have that environment. And the psychological safety is a really fundamental part of that. So how do we create the environment where it's not only okay to talk about failure, but we actively encourage talking about failure in the right way and learning from it? And we have to show that through role modelling. We have to show that in the actions we take every day. We have to also, I think, make sure one of the challenges, I think, around psychological safety is the depth of understanding that psychological safety is not about everything feeling nice and comfortable. Psychological safety is about things feeling really challenging and uncomfortable and still having the trust there that we go forward and we celebrate success and everybody has a voice in that. And I think that has been part of our journey where we're starting to now create that shared understanding that it is about continuing to push each other and to be, you can be assertive and create clear direction and still have a really thriving, positive culture with great psychological safety.
Could you give a small example of how that looks on a day-to-day basis, let's say with the leadership team or, you know, on the day-to-day work? What is one example of that feedback culture?
So let's take what happens after a race. When we come back to the factory, when everybody's back at the factory and James Vowles is here, let's say on a Monday or a Tuesday, depending on where the race has been. So everybody's invited to the race bay. We come together, we stand together, and our values are written on the wall, which I think is important. And James takes us through what happened at the weekend and why, and what we learned and what went well and what didn't, and how we intend to take that forward and what will happen at the next race. So it's very open, clear, transparent, honest, and doesn't take too long. And everybody comes or tunes into that, and we celebrate when things go well. And we learn from our failure and build the resilience in that way. So that is a really great moment and a powerful example, I think. And then also in the engineering, in the performance teams, the way they debrief now when they come back to the factory has those protocols of people really taking accountability for, you know, what I did well, what I didn't do well, what I can do differently next time. And I think it is just building those protocols and habits and growing them across the organization in a way that is really normalized. I think the other thing that we've worked really hard to do is that beneath our five values are 12 specific high performance behaviors, and creating that common language where people can use those behaviors to really objectively observe and give feedback and take accountability for how they've performed as well. You start to build that in a way that isn't emotional, it's very objective, actionable, specific, etc. And I think that over time it takes practice, but I think that really builds that performance focused culture where people feel again safe and trusted, where everybody's held to the same standards.
So it sounds like you're actually living those values and behaviours. Did they change with the change in ownership leadership in the last few years towards a specific goal?
Yes, we changed them, although I would say we evolved them. So we've been very respectful and thoughtful about the legacy and making sure that we talk to people who had been here for a long time, as well as people that had joined more recently, but also linking it very much to the strategy and what we believe it will take to win and return to winning. So it is that evolution from the legacy that we have and being thoughtful about that and what makes Williams Williams, but then takes us forward into the future. And for me, I think values will never mean anything if they're words on a page, but it really, again, takes practice. So back to our theme of patience, this is, again, multiple years. So first of all, you have to agree and align on, you know, what are our values, then think about what our set of high performance behaviors and really define those for us and our strategy. And then help people to become aware of them, why they're important, how it will drive performance. And it takes a long time, honestly. So this year, I think, as we step into 2026, what we started to do last year was create a much better understanding of stories from around the organization. So we had people anywhere in the organization who could say, I had this problem, we used these behaviors, the performance outcome changed as a result. And just starting to share those stories of performance has started to really strengthen what the values mean in real life.
Very powerful. And you mentioned people who've been there a long time, the legacy. What is the shorter serving employee and the longer serving employee in terms of years, or weeks or months? Do you have people who were there at the beginning or quite close to the beginning? I guess many of them have retired now.
So we were founded in 1977, which is nearly 50 years ago. I don't think we have anybody who's been here quite since day one, but we definitely have people who have many people who have multiple decades of experience in the business. And one of the core parts of our team is actually the heritage team who still run the cars, our heritage cars. So that's it's not just the people, but also the cars that we take care of over many decades. And equally, we've had people that have joined this year just a few days ago.
So let me go to another area that Formula One is under pressure from is around the area of sustainability. And I understand that F1 has set themselves a goal of a net zero carbon goal by 2030, and also the introduction of hybrid fuels being rolled out. So from your perspective of CHRO, how do those sorts of goals and challenges show up in the culture and talent decisions?
So I think about sustainability really broadly. So you're right, from a sporting perspective, the fuel is this season is a big change in almost every sense from a regulatory environment perspective. And that includes, the fuel and the engine. But I think about sustainability more broadly in the team. And actually, my focus is around sustainability of the business and our performance. So how do we create a culture and a leadership which really builds something that will endure beyond us? And so the talent that comes into the organization and how we build and develop people, again, held together with those five values and the same behaviors and a clear mission to win. I think of, from a sort of chief people officer perspective, that's really currently my focus.
And could you share those five values and which one is the one that currently needs most work?
That's a great question. So Our values, our five values are innovation, teamwork, resilience, excellence, and accountability. And there are 12 behaviours that sit underneath those, and they are actually rooted in the Schroeder model of high performance. And we've adapted them really for Williams, as I say, for the language and culture and mission that we're on today. They work together as a system. So it's really hard to say that there's one that matters more than the other, because it really works if you think about it like a loop. So you start with innovation. So how do we create ideas? Take it through the teamwork. How do we build those ideas together and deliver together? All the way through to excellence, which is about making sure that we raise the bar every day and continuous improvement. And accountability is really about execution. So they really do work very much together. And, you know, I think I could talk to people in the building endlessly about which one needs most attention. But what I'm really focused on is making sure that we have a system where all of those are in evidence in different ways at different times. And different roles require some people to be more innovative than others. And we're helping people to differentiate on that basis. But all of them, I think, are equally important.
Beautiful. So it's a systemic.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I think that's important because, again, going back to this sustainable performance and leadership, if you over index on one of the values, it can start to drown out some of the others.
And you mentioned, you know, obviously it's high pressure, high scrutiny and rapid feedback. How do you handle well-being? Resilience is one of the values. You know, do people get to burnout levels? This is an elite performance. Yeah. How does that show up in programs or support systems in the day-to-day?
It's complex, Susan, thinking about well-being and how do we take care of people every day and prevent burnout, because it is really demanding and relentless, as many organisations are these days. And of course, we're in transformation as well, so it's even more demanding. But we really do care. I think we have systems and process to help take care of people and support. And in addition, really encourage people to really, it's the act of leadership is for leaders and managers to really understand their teams and, you know, where's the high pressure, where's the recovery opportunity, and to manage it at that level and the individual level, and for individuals to feel they can take some ownership of that themselves as well, I think is incredibly important. And really our job in terms of well-being is, as well as the creating the programs, is actually to create the environment where we have that psychological safety, because a lot of the recent research shows actually that your line manager has more impact on your mental and well-being than your partner at home, you know, and that makes sense. So how do we equip managers with the skills to really take that seriously and create the environment where people don't feel stressed because they can't talk about their challenges at work or at home? And I think it is just about creating the environment, rather than, I think in business generally there's a move away from some of the gimmicks to really creating the culture and environment where people can be successful. That said, I think, you know, there are some practicalities of this, and I think the FIA made a really sensible decision a few years ago where there is a mandated shutdown in the summer and over the holiday season, Christmas, and that is really important, because if teams weren't forced to take a break, it's so competitive, everybody would be compelled to keep working. So that gives you those natural breaks in the year and that time for recovery. So it's complex, as with many of these things, and a work in progress. But that's just a little bit of insight into some of the things that are working for us.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And may I ask what helps you personally reset and recenter?
Yeah, I've had to take this really seriously, because I think it's important as leaders that we don't hide away from the fact and we don't sort of pretend that it's not hard and challenging. I have to give this job a massive, massive part of my time, my life, my energy. I also have a family. I have two teenage boys and I have a long commute. So there are lots of things that are making this really, really challenging. And so for me personally, you know, this is not for everybody, and it wasn't how I operated when I was, you know, in my 20s or whatever, but I really do have to take care of the basics, the foundations. I have to make sure that I, as far as possible, I take care of the way that I sleep, move, eat, those things. And it's not exciting or sexy, but, you know, I just need to take care of those things. So I don't drink very much these days. I take exercise more seriously, and you just have to find a way to fit it in if you're going to perform.
fits with the accountability value.
Yes, very much so. And, you know, the good news is I love my job. This is incredibly rewarding. I love my family. They're amazing too. And somehow, you know, it just about works and it ebbs and flows. And some days are better than others. But yeah, it's important, I think, that we all take accountability to find our own way of managing this. And, you know, yeah. Sleep is often compromised, but it's a work in progress.
Thank you for sharing that. And in an industry like F1, where it's very attractive for people to want to work, do you find that there is a lot of passion? People who choose to work in F1 or are fortunate enough to work in F1 are passionate, and so by that very nature do have to self-manage?
Definitely. I think it really helps, obviously, to be passionate about the sport. And I think once you're on the inside, even if, like me, you didn't grow up as an F1 fan, but it quickly gets into your blood and it is really compelling. And we have the advantage of seeing it from the inside. But yeah, I mean, last year, look, you know, more than 80,000 candidates applied to be part of Williams, which is just an enormous number. And it's not for everyone, and it definitely looks much more glossy on the outside than it is on the inside. I promise you that. It's really important that as we talk about, you know, our employee value proposition, which we call our people promise, we're really, really honest about what it takes to work here. We don't have necessarily, because we're a small and lean team, we have to operate within a cost cap environment. We don't have the luxuries that a lot of other organizations that would have in terms of support. We're doing our best, but it is an environment which is demanding, and it's really important that we are honest about that. It's also a team going through enormous transformation, and we have to be able to operate at the same time. So it seems on the outside glossy and exciting, and it definitely feels like that, and I love it with my heart and soul. We also try and be really honest that whilst we believe we can offer opportunities where everybody can shape the future, at the same time, we try and help people to decide really in the right way if this is really for them.
So it sounds like you're very explicit around the psychological contract.
We're very explicit and we don't sugarcoat it.
What is one insight that you've gleaned from your coming into your third year now with Formula One that you think could be of benefit to other CHROs?
Well, that's a great question. I think complexity is everywhere and it can threaten to drown us all in business, whether you're a CPO or a CFO or a CEO or whatever job you're in, you know, complexity is there. And I think in any fast-moving organization where you're also transforming, it's really important to somehow thread a way through that complexity and make sure that you really do focus on some of the simple things. So there's a new book out, John Amici, It's Not Magic, which I think is a brilliant book that really talks about going back to some of the basics. And that's part of the way that I think about my experience here is it can eat you alive, or you can create direction, align with the business strategy, and stay really true to that and build it brick by brick. So for us, it's really aspirational. The ambition is absolutely there. So the people strategy here is to build an elite team and a high performance culture. And because we believe we won't win without that. So it's deliberately aspirational. But the way that you get there is to create this very clear direction, programs, and build it brick by brick and meet the business where it is, meet people where they are, and then very quickly evolve from there. So be ambitious with energy, but just try and thread a simple path through complex issues.
So have the big, hairy, audacious goal, but look at it step by step.
Yes. So we are not at all frightened of ambition, but it is that sort of dogged determination possibly that wins the day with the odd breakthrough.
How many races do you attend in a season? And which is your favourite circuit?
I have been really fortunate to go to track. Not everybody does. And last year I went to 2 races. So I obviously keep it proportionate to where I can add value. And I think, yeah, the race that I enjoyed the most was in Austin. And I think that was one of my favourite weekends so far. And we had the opportunity to visit some of the universities, which just again gives us the opportunity to connect with future talent wherever it is and really inspire. If I go to one of the race weekends, it's usually for a reason, either to visit a university or to work with one of our partners. So for example, with Komatsu, we run an engineering academy for select students from around the world. And so there's usually a purpose to the race weekends that I attend.
That's powerful. Do you have remote roles, virtual jobs, or is it all located where the headquarters is?
Yeah, we've stayed very much focused on being in person. So we have different locations. So we're in three locations, in Grove in Oxfordshire, in London, and in New York, a few people there as well. But fundamentally, we are an in-person organisation.
What do you think other businesses can learn most from Formula One?
Whilst a lot of what I found when I joined Williams was really familiar to me in terms of being an engineering, operations, technology organisation that felt very familiar, obviously the overlay of sport brings a completely different aspect to work and life. And I think it really has brought home to me the criticality of purpose and a mission that really unites everybody. And for helping, you know, if your organisation isn't clear on the mission that really unites people, that really is worth digging into. And with some emotional resonance as well, it's easy for us, but it does mean the lows are probably lower, but it means that the highs are higher. I mean, I've been part of some amazing, incredible organisations doing massive deals, but it's not very often that people cry with joy when things go well. So you may not get that in business, but finding something that really emotionally resonates and builds a team is critical. And then the other thing is just the power of people. And it does exist in lots of different organisations and businesses. But, you know, what people are willing to give, if you get those things right, is really extraordinary. And the lengths that people will go to. And I have seen that in other organisations. You know, when there's a crisis, people really do step up and people are amazing. And again, just don't underestimate the power of, you know, how can you kind of harness that mindset and that commitment and that loyalty in a way that is more sustainable and can show up every day.
Beautiful advice. Thank you so much, Anne. It's been an absolute pleasure and privilege to speak with you, and wishing you and Atlassian Williams every success in 2026.
Thank you so much, Susan.
If you enjoyed this conversation, subscribe to iBuyIMD on your favorite podcast platform. iBuyIMD is brought to you by the Institute for Management Development. Find out more at imd.org. See you soon.